into sports.
20 yards out, Hurst to shoot, don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah. No.
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network.
The News Round on Off The Ball.
With Gillette. We don't just play the game, we change it. Gillette, made of what matters.
This is News Talk.
Hello, you're welcome along. Tuesday's Off The Ball. Lydia Hislop is a journalist broadcaster. She'll give us the UK perspective on Gordon Elliott's situation, which is continuing apace. Dan McDonnell on the football show, World Cup 2030. Ireland part of a joint bid, it seems, or certainly the initial stages of one. We'll talk to Dan later on, between 9 and 10. Luca Allen, he is the 19-year-old making serious waves in motor racing. He has his eye on Formula One, hopefully down the line. Colm Keyes on GAA Congress and more besides. 53106 is the text number. We're at Off The Ball on Twitter. Nathan Murphy, I've got you.
Loud and clear.
Loud and clear. World Cup 2030, how does that sound to you?
Well, I don't know. I'm somewhat
that excited.
I think anybody who's ever been to a World Cup knows the magic of being in a whole city on a weekend where there's games and all these people from all parts of the world congregating together and the party atmosphere, and how could you not want some of that? But at the same time, it does feel right now it's a convenient political sideshow to be involving us in a World Cup bid. I was listening to the Minister for Sport, Jack Chambers, on News Talk Breakfast this morning, and it's a good reminder of why politicians love these bids, because it gives them an opportunity to just dodge the real conversations that should be going on around Irish sport. They love the fact that it goes on for several years, which means for the next 2-3 years, we're going to get all the familiar platitudes rolled out. I saw today words like the football family will be rolling in behind this, words that mean absolutely nothing. And because there's no decision till 2024, maybe they decide not to go ahead with the bid between now and then, there'll be lots of questions about the government's attitude to sport, where they will point towards the World Cup bid. They're bidding for the World Cup finals itself, the biggest event in all of sport. Look at the ambition that they are showing compared to anybody else. Whereas it feels as though it's a bit of a dream. It's a bit of a look at this shiny thing over here compared to where we are in reality right now, where sport in this country is in the midst of an unprecedented crisis. Every sporting organization is suffering catastrophic losses. Sport at grassroots level has been stopped for 3-4 months. We have kids who barely played a game in a year, and football in this country is on its knees. That we're bidding for a World Cup while the FAI are in debt of well over £50 million, have no national team sponsor, we don't have supporters going to games for the foreseeable future. We have a league starting in the next few weeks that will be played in grounds that are by and large pretty dilapidated. And surely if there's investment going, that is where it needs to go. And that's where the Minister for Sport needs to be focusing right now. What is the plan to avoid COVID inflicting further long-term damage to sport in this country? And when I hear Jack Chambers doing the rounds today, that's what I would prefer to hear him talking about. We've tried to get him to come on Off The Ball over the last few months. We put in countless requests to talk about the bigger picture stuff, and he doesn't seem to want to come on, but he's happy to do the short pieces that are selling the dream that we'll all get behind for the next 5-6 years in the hope it may happen, when the reality is it seems highly unlikely. And when you dig down into the details, it's at such early stages. We're again talking about bringing it outside Dublin, opening it up. It'll need every community in town will get involved. We may be upgrading GAA stadiums, all the usual nonsense that goes with it, when there are so many more pressing issues that really we need the Minister for Sport to be dealing with right now.
So you think when Boris Johnson says we're bringing football home, it's the right time, you think that's a populist line, do you?
Well, even that line in itself was a line that came up a lot after the humiliation that England suffered. We're going into this with England. It feels a bit like trying to set up a hotel business with Donald Trump right now. It's pretty toxic to be going looking for votes alongside England. they were absolutely humiliated the last time, in albeit what was a pretty corrupt vote. But has their attitude changed? A lot of what was fed back, regardless of everything else that went on behind the scenes, was the arrogance of England expecting to get it. This football coming home narrative. The 100th anniversary of the World Cup is coming up in 1930. Uruguay are going to be part of a South American bidding process. But no, football should come home. Yes, England are in a position because of the stadium they have that they can go and chase this down. They may well end up hosting the Euros this year. But it is a perfectly timed and one-way distraction for Boris Johnson, for the Irish government, for everybody to say, look what we may have in the future. And in one way, Jack Chambers shouldn't be talking about this, because it's not a, while it is a sporting event, any money that goes towards this should not come out of any pot that is anywhere near sport. This is a tourism project. This is a big event. They've talked about setting up a sort of mini department around big events, that while the sport will be played, the main beneficiaries would be of a, from a tourism point of view. I know there's any amount of debates as to how much money you actually make out of tourism, but my concern would be that this is, there's some pot of money that should be going to sport over the next 8 years, if in the slim chance they were to actually be awarded it, gets funneled towards a World Cup rather than where we are desperately going to need it over the coming years.
Do you know what, Nathan, on your point there, right? Because you mentioned that, you know, Jack Chambers hasn't necessarily been the most available person to get hold of during the course of the pandemic. Like, just let's park this to one side. We're not getting the World Cup. That this 2030 is not going to happen. It's not going to come here. We'll just put a pin in that. But on your point about Chambers, what has struck me in the last couple of weeks, and especially in and around the French rugby COVID stuff, and it's happened before then when talking about the French Open tennis, or when talking about the national leagues, be it the top 14 or Ligue 1, the French sports minister, by comparison, Roxana Marissignano, has been everywhere. And anytime she's been requested of an interview, anytime that a camera's been put in front of her, a microphone's been put in front of her, she's had something to say, and had something worthwhile to say, whether it was pleasant or not, regarding sports outlook in the country over in France, either on a macro or a micro scale. We haven't seen anything like that here. And that is what Jack Chambers and his department should actually be concentrating on, not fanciful notions of bringing part of a World Cup here in 2030 here, when really and truly it should be just left to South America and that Uruguay bid to mark the centenary, and a bit of cop-on be used. But he needs to be more visible. He needs to be more involved in how sport is getting back to itself in this country post-pandemic, because he hasn't done that yet. And the distractions of a 2030 possible World Cup bid need to be looked past, and quickly, because he's not doing his job on that front. Mm.
England, by the way, in that 2018 bid, which ultimately went the way of Russia, spent $23 million on the bidding process. Prince William, David Beckham, David Cameron, you remember, all rolled out. They finished last of the four who made it through to the final bidding, two votes out of 22. I think their sense is, well, we were the only ones who weren't corrupt. You know, that's the line they're spinning. But $23 million was spent just to not get the World Cup, which is huge sum of money. Tell us how you really feel, Nathan, says Kevin.
Listen, I would love, as we're talking on a sports program, we would be among the main beneficiaries of a World Cup if it was to come to Ireland in 9 years' time. And maybe there's no harm in doing these initial studies just to get a sense of the possibility and put feelers out there around UEFA, and Jonathan Hill can zoom in on all the meetings and get a sense, is there a bit of momentum behind it? Because at the moment, there's several bids coming out of Europe alone for 2030. And of course, we have lost a very influential figure around European football in recent times within the FAI, Joe, that wouldn't help us in such a bid. But while it's great to have ambition and it's great to have an end goal as we come out of, hopefully, this pandemic, it just feels that Irish sport is going to need so much investment in so many different ways that it is just going to be this golden goose at the end that may never arrive, and that will be a perfect distraction for politicians for years going forward.
Mm. What age is everyone in 9 years' time? Don't think about
that. That was the first thing I thought.
Don't do that, Matt. Don't do those, Matt.
I did the world.
Yeah, I did the one the other week whereby Brisbane was the preferred bidder for the 2032 Olympics.
Yeah.
And I looked at it and I went, no.
Dear,
no, Sydney was 5 years ago. How would that be 32 years apart? And
there we are.
It's not good. It's not good, Joe.
I've often done this thing where I'll double my age and think, I'm still doing okay. That's getting less and less positive.
Try adding kids to that show.
Oh, man. I should say as well, just to mark your card for where the World Cup is going, this wonderful tournament, as of 2026, so after this Qatar business is over with, we'll be in the USA and Canada and Mexico. I hadn't really looked this far ahead because it is so far ahead, but USA, Canada, Mexico for 2026. And we are going from 32 to 48 teams at the World Cup. There will be, at World Cup 2026, 80 matches. 80 matches at the World Cup. So, I mean, it's getting bigger and better all the time. This won't really all kick off till 2022 is when the bidding opens, and then it'll be decided in 2024. So, we'll see. The UK have put forward 2.8 million sterling to kick off some kind of feasibility study as part of their budget this week. So that's how this has all come about. Let's get into the news round then. It is, as ever, with thanks to our friends at Gillette. They don't just play the game, they change it. Gillette made of what matters. And Richie, we're starting with the latest on the Gordon Elliott situation.
Yeah, an IHRB referrals committee is to meet on Friday to hear evidence relating to that photo of Gordon Elliott on a dead horse. Elliott has been barred from entering runners in the UK by the British Horse Racing Authority while that investigation is ongoing. Meanwhile, Cheveley Park Stud became the first major owner to remove horses from Elliott following that controversial photo's release. Stud owner Patricia Thompson has confirmed that 8 horses, including the unbeaten Envoy Allen, will be leaving Elliott and split between Willie Mullins and Henry de Bromhead's yards. In an interview with the Racing Post overnight, Elliott said the photo was indefensible and a moment of madness that he'll be paying for the rest of his life.
Oh, sorry, I thought that was audio coming. Yeah, of course, it was just in the Racing Post. And then Tiger Roll.
Yeah, Jigginstown have blamed an unfair wait for withdrawing Tiger Roll from April's Grand National. The BHA handicapper had saddled the back-to-back winner with a £7 increase from his 2019 win. Tiger Roll's withdrawal is unrelated to the Gordon Elliott photo controversy. And on a similar tip, I guess, Rob James has confirmed that he is the individual sitting on another dead horse in a video circulating on social media. The Cheltenham Festival winning amateur jockey has issued an apology over the clip, which is being investigated as well by the IHRB. It's been reported that the footage is from April 2016 and shows James sitting aboard a deceased 5-year-old mare on an unidentified gallop.
Nathan, we all talked about this at length on last night's show and we're covering it again this evening. Later on, we'll get a UK perspective on where Gordon Elliott's career is. What have you made of the last few days?
I think he covered it very well on the show last night. I think the casualness of the photograph is what made it so damaging, that in a way, this wasn't an undercover raid where there was an element of gotcha. This was him sitting there knowing the photograph was being taken with a smile on his face, which raises questions as to, well, it didn't feel like it was an out of the ordinary thing, because the initial reaction was you go straight to the person who took the photograph and say, delete that, that I've made a mistake, delete it. That didn't happen. I'm interested to hear what the British viewpoint is, because I think the decision last night to ban him immediately from racing in Britain, a temporary ban, really brought into sharp focus just how serious this is. Mm. And it's probably a reminder of how important the Grand National and the Cheltenham Gold Cup are in British sport, that the Grand National is the blue ribboned event of British horse racing. It is a day unlike any other that captures the imagination unlike any other. And to have Tiger Roll as the winner of the last two renewals up until today, going in looking to win it for a third time, all the comparisons with Red Rum, all of that, and for Gordon Elliott to be associated with that would be so damaging for British racing. It'll be interesting to see how the next 48, 72 hours develop. It's still almost impossible to see how Gordon Elliott has horses under his name running at Cheltenham. We see already there's a little bit of a clear out happening. I presume that will continue over the coming days. But it's hard to remember a story like this within a sport that has, I don't want to say captured the imagination, but I think it was touched on last night. I've had people who would rarely comment on sport texting me, asking me, what's the story behind this? Everybody is interested to know, is this what really happens within horse racing? And as we saw today, there's more coming out, and unfortunately, it doesn't feel like this is going away anytime soon.
Yeah, Cheveley Park took their 8 horses. I was listening to Richard Thompson, their director, and at the races this morning, and he was saying that yesterday the magnitude of the story was hitting them, because initially they had said they were going to wait until the outcome of the investigation. That was the Cheveley Park line, but they've taken their 8 horses now. Envoy Allen in particular, you know, catches the guy for obvious reasons, has gone to Henry de Bromhead, a couple of horses to Willie Mullins as well. And the British Horse Racing Authority move is unprecedented. Like, they are not in charge of this case at all. They've acted unilaterally. Horse Racing Ireland and the IHRB are obviously in charge. So it will be interesting to have Liddy on and get a sense of the thinking there. You know, this is pretty much unprecedented. You've got to think it's going to have a bearing on the sanction. Will they continue with the suspension if they're not happy with the sanction that comes out of Ireland? All of these questions are swirling around. And it'd
the
be
legal
my
aspects of that are going to be interesting, because it's hard to imagine there is a sanction appropriate for this. I know it was touched on in the piece you did with Johnny Ward and Richard Forrestal last night about where he would probably be charged.
Yeah.
But while what he has done has damaged the sport, it's hard to imagine, it's hard to remember anything in living memory that has damaged horse racing, or really any sport, one incident damaging a sport to the extent that this seems to have done over the last 48 hours. And how do you punish that appropriately?
Appropriately is fair, is the thing, isn't it? And look, we couldn't have condemned it more last night, and we thought his statement, frankly, the initial one was bordering on the ridiculous. But as well, he's a human being. You're conscious of his mental health. You're conscious of, you know, he made the point of the Racing Post. He's watching his career fall apart. So it's really, really difficult to actually find the appropriate punishment. You know, when you think, if you were at that meeting on Friday and they said, Nathan, what's the appropriate punishment here? Like, what's the answer? You know, it's very difficult.
Because there is a punishment that will go alongside it no matter what. There will be a long-term impact on his business, because any amount of owners are going to leave and not return. Mm. So that part of it, he is going to have to take. It is then what sort of a ban, what sort of a fine. Mm. And they have to get that right from the sport's point of view as well. But in one way, it's just part of it, because the long-term consequences are going to be severe no matter what the fine or ban is.
Yeah, I heard the point as well. We'll ask Lydia about this, that maybe one of the motivations behind the British Horse Racing Authority's move is that there is a much stronger anti-racing lobby over in the UK. Like, here it's a very mainstream sport. It's a big sport in the media. It's a source, I think, of national pride, probably, or sporting pride. Certainly it's rare for a country of this size to be a leading light in anything internationally. You know, Ruby Walsh and Willie Mullins conquering Cheltenham is one of the annual great stories that everybody here seems to love. Whereas in the UK, I think, whilst it's obviously a huge sport, it's very much a minority sport. And even the Labour Party, in their manifesto, I was looking back pre-Christmas, if they get into office, I mean, the Labour Party really aren't sure about the whip, for instance, as a, you know, should the whip be allowed as a tool of motivation, for instance. So there is more, I think, attention on the anti-racing lobby over there. So Lydia might fill us in on all that. It might hopefully be an interesting chat. We'll get a sense of the mood over there. But that's where we are. And as, look, the jockey then, I mean, if you're sitting now in British Horse Racing Authority offices or Horse Racing Ireland, or you know, connected with the sport in any way, and someone was to say to you, do you think that that's the last photo or video of this kind? Like, would you put your mortgage on it? I think you'd be pretty worried right now, and that's the other concern for the sport. So it's all bubbling away. Johnny Sexton.
New contract. He today signed a new one-year deal, a central deal with the IRFU. It keeps the Ireland captain at Leinster until at least the end of next season, and Leinster assistant coach Robin McBride is happy that Sexton's experience is staying within the group.
Yeah, I think you take every year as it comes when you get to a certain age. The body will tell you, you know, if you can go on. And if the body won't, the mind certainly will. Somebody like Johnny, they expect high standards, you know, and if you don't, if you start falling short of those standards, then you know yourself that it's time to move on. So, he'll make that decision when it's right and proper. You know, as long as he's enjoying his rugby, and, you know, in the current climate, there's not a lot else going on. So we're very fortunate to be able to play rugby, and, you know, that's going to keep him going as well. So great stuff.
He was very good at the weekend. We had Brian O'Driscoll on last night in Monday Night Rugby. You can listen back to it or podcast it or get it on social media. He was saying that he texted Sexton afterwards to say that was your best individual performance in a very long time. to which Sexton didn't write back. Which is so good.
He was taking each contract as it comes.
Yes, indeed. There's a text in, where is this Trump OTB hotel? What are the room rates like? Wonders Sam in Uri. Keith in Dublin 2 makes a very fair point. Lads, stop with the World Cup negativity. Remember, they all laughed at the Eurovision going to Mill Street. Dare to dream, which is a great point.
They made a great documentary about that too, Joe.
That was on that run where we won it about five or six times, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, Niamh Cavanagh won it down there, yeah.
Was it Niamh Cavanagh who won at Mill Street?
Yeah.
Right. And was it just Mill Street in Dublin?
Mill Street did in Cork, and the Point hosted it. It had been in the RDS prior to that with our own Pat Kenny and Michelle Rocca back in 88, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, other than that, it's all been O2 and, the Point as it was then. And yeah, the Gaiety actually held it back in the day, back in the 70s after Dana won it, yeah.
Did it? That's a cool venue.
Yeah, very cool.
All right, I've no more questions about it. That was it, really.
If you need to know more about Eurovision.
We're not still talking about it 25 years on, and we're still not doing a half 40 minutes on the Late Late Show 25 years on with the all the winners. Mind you, any time you get to hear Rock and Roll Kids, never have a problem with that.
Agreed. That is the best of them, isn't it?
Oh, by far.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that is the best.
I do have a lot of time for In Your Eyes, to be fair.
Yeah.
I'm going to put this out there, and Richie, you will know. Charlie McGettigan is Philip Egan's uncle.
Is he?
There's a relationship there. I put it out there. Phil can confirm himself. But I'm fairly sure there might have been a rendition at the Phil Egan wedding.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
Very nice. All right, lads, we'll have to kick on, get back to the old sport.
Oh, why?
Richie, go on.
Why me?
Wolves stand between Manchester City and a 21st consecutive win in all competitions tonight. A City win at the Etihad would see them establish a 15-point lead over neighbours Manchester United at the top of the table. Kickoff is at 8 o'clock. While Ian St John has been hailed as one of the architects of modern Liverpool, the former Red striker has died at the age of 82. St John scored 118 goals in 425 Liverpool appearances, helping them twice win the title under Bill Shankly. Alongside fellow ex-pro Jimmy Greaves, the Scot formed an iconic television tandem during the 80s and early 90s. A former Liverpool captain and current Rangers boss Steven Gerrard was among those paying tribute to the Saint.
He's an iconic figure at Liverpool Football Club. He's someone who I've met on numerous occasions, and fantastic guy. Really insightful in terms of his career and his experience at Liverpool, and trying to pass on a lot of knowledge and expertise. So, really devastated to hear that news, to be honest with you. And shocked as well. So, I'd like to send my condolences to all his family and everyone close to the Saint. He's a legend and an iconic figure at the club, and someone who I've got incredible respect for.
Mark Lawrenson's going to join us actually on the football show and pay tribute as well. The football show passed me by.
St. Graves, you were too young, were you?
I don't know exactly. Either too young or else didn't have the channels at the time. But just
I think you're probably too young, because by 92, obviously with the introduction of the Premier League, it had been relegated to. There we go. It had been relegated to just NZ League coverage.
So what's this?
That's the team tune. That's the second team tune to St. Graves, which was originally ITV's.
One of the Eurovision winners.
That was originally ITV's 1986 World Cup team, and was composed by one half of the songwriting team behind The Zombies, Rod Argent. So a man with many musical talents, was Rod. But yeah, St. Greaves was pretty much for anyone a little bit older than yourself, Joe, which I'd include myself among that. And I feel like The Office was the same
thing. So popular.
Oh, huge. Yeah. It was the only... That and a match on ITV every 3 weeks was the only output from the UK. Now, I know RTE would show matches on a Saturday and sometimes deferred by half an hour or whatever, but it's a completely different time when 45 minutes of St. Greavesy and potentially a match every fortnight, every 3 weeks, was all you got from England. Mm. And you were happy enough with it. So there were iconic figures in the game, if only for their TV work. And Ian St. John was a better host than I think a lot of people gave him credit for.
Right.
But first and foremost, a magnificent player, and one who was on whose shoulders the current Liverpool was built.
Yeah, well, we'll pay tribute to him on the football show. I think we should stick with the Ryder Cup and Adair in a few years, lads. World Rowing Championships, very achievable. World Match Play Golf Tournament, achievable. Formula One race, achievable, is it? Formula One is achievable? Don't think so.
Not at all.
NFL game or two may be achievable. World Cup soccer bid in Fairyland, says a texter. Lads, I'm aiming to retire in 2030 after 40 years of work, says Mick in Dublin, and that's half the pension gone on tickets if we get the World Cup. Mick, I think you're going to be all right.
I think we've all been burnt by the Euro 2020 experience, where, again, they sell you the dream of Ireland against Brazil in Croke Park. Whereas, like a lot of people have, you've end up spending 250 quid on tickets for Poland against Slovakia at the Aviva Stadium.
Brazil getting to the Euros would have been quite an achievement, though.
Can I hit you with
to the Euros, yes.
Can I hit you with massive bonus points if you get this right? And if you've just tuned in, there's no point back explaining this, but here we go. 1992, this was our streak. This was it. Linda Martin with Why Me, 155 points. 1993, Niamh Kavanagh, In Your Eyes, 187 points. Yeah. Paul Harrington, Charlie McGettigan, 1994. This was three in a row, Rock and Roll Kids. 226 points. I think that's a record based on everything I'm seeing around it. I'm skipping 1 year. 1996, Emer Quinn, The Voice, first as well, 162 points. The question is, who finished 14th for Ireland in that in-between year of 1995?
Oh.
Well, I know Mark Roberts came.
That was 97.
Second.
Yeah. With Mysterious Woman.
Mark in Galway. Yes.
Was it Mysterious Woman as in like the Peter Andre song?
No.
All right.
No. Jesus. No.
That would be
certainly not.
An Irish man shouldn't be singing that.
95.
I've got to go here. Talks against
you. Did we let Johnny Logan in again?
No, we didn't. No.
Oh, God. Come on, break it to us.
Eddie Friel with Dreamin'.
That's right.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. That's right.
Not a great song.
There you go. There you go. See, kids, the 90s were fun.
Absolutely were.
Right, we actually have to go. Richie McCormack, thank you. Nathan Murphy, thank you.
Cheers.
We've got a busy show on the way, including up next. We're going to go over to Lydia Hislop, broadcaster and journalist, racing journalist, to talk to us about the latest in the Gordon Elliott situation and give us the UK perspective.
The News Round on Off the Ball.
With Gillette. We don't just play the game, we change it. Gillette, made of what matters.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.